This is another episode of the Welcome To podcast brought to you by the Land Information Access Association out of Traverse City, Michigan, bringing you innovative solutions for sustainable communities. I'm your host, community planner Zach Vega. Be sure to follow Welcome To on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, the Stitcher app, or however else you get your audio content, and go to liaa.org to see what else our nonprofit is working on.
And welcome back to Welcome To, the podcast for planners and people with such long drives that they've run out of content in all their mainstream forms of media. That's just who I assume my audience is. I don't really know. Hey, everybody. So if you're new to the podcast, we might have some newbies in the building. And, you know, with this being episode 11 and us just rolling along, I just wanted to reiterate why we, and when I say we, I mean me alone in a room, are doing this. So I'm a pretty fresh planner. Just finished up my master's at Michigan State in urban and regional planning this past May of 2019. So I'm the new guy in the office. And I'm always wanting to call people up to ask them questions about planning. And also, I'm a nerd, you guys. So I was the guy who would go into professors' offices and be like, just tell me what autonomous vehicles are. Tell me everything you know. And they would, and that was really nice. And it was cool to walk around, you know, the human ecology building at MSU and get all these answers from the people who are at the forefront of this research, as well as practitioners who I worked with as well during my time there and who I work with now. And that was really exciting. But it's a little awkward to say, hey, do you have an hour that you can spend where I'll just show up to your office and ask you questions and it won't be weird at all. And I didn't think that was a good use of resources and their time. So I thought, why not record these episodes and then more people can benefit from it? And the podcast was born from that. And I know that's pretty much what every other podcast is, but I like to think it was a novel idea. So anyways, with that, so that's the purpose of the podcast. It's we've got, check out the other episodes. We've got Dome Ecology, Charrettes, all things that are new planning topics, new planning ideas. And if, you know, some of them are like informal housing, maybe it's something that's been around for a while, but we just haven't collected the data on it. I think it's all interesting stuff. I hope you guys do too. And, anyways, so with that, the reason I wanted to reintroduce the purpose of the podcast is that we're going to be introducing a new... that was just me. We don't have drops on this thing. We could, though. There's 8 spots for it. We are... And again, when I say we, me alone in a room, crazy person. Woo! Northern Michigan in winter, guys. Russian novelist. I'm a Siberian author, you guys. I'm just in a cold room with a sweater, doing research and planning, which is fine. So one issue that I've noticed since graduating from Michigan State is that when you don't have access to electronic journal articles, it makes it really hard to know what's going on in the planning world in terms of research. So I don't have access to knowing, does a specific traffic pattern influence commercial behavior? Does it even make sense? Sometimes I just put a bunch of planning jargon words together and hope that they make sense. So then I was placemaking at the local mixed use development, uptown. Took a bus rapid transit to get there, and people just nod their heads and assume I know what I'm talking about. So, which is why I have to have people on the show who do know what they're talking about. But so in addition to the episodes that are coming out once every 3 weeks or so, is kind of how I've been releasing them. I also wanted to address the issue of it being difficult for people to get access to literature on specific topics like transportation or the built environment and how it affects really just a range of things like behavior and spending habits and happiness, and, you know, whatever. So I will be doing the literature review for you. We'll do a verbal literature review. Those will be shorter episodes, maybe 10 to 15 minutes, maybe less. I don't know. It might not even be interesting. Maybe I'll make it 5 minutes and we'll just plow through it. But basically, it'll be, I don't know what to call it. We'll figure out a name for it. It'll either be lit planning or planning lit or something to do with literature. I don't know. I'll get more creative than that. Sorry, that's so boring. Planning lit. We'll find something interesting to call it. But, God, I'm just rambling. So look out for those episodes. Those will have topics listed with them. They'll be shorter. I'll go through what researchers from around the globe are finding, and we'll talk about it, and I'll just break it down as to what their methods were, what their study size was, what the findings mean for us, all of that as planners. So that's enough of that. Let's get into our guest for the day. Bum, bum, big celebration for our guest today, everybody. I'm super excited to introduce Robert Gibbs of Gibbs Planning Group. If you don't know who Bob Gibbs is, show me the rock you've been living under. What's the real estate value? Bob was named by PlanEdison as the number 7 most influential urbanist of all time. And if you're not an urbanist yourself, you might be thinking, oh, what's the big deal? That doesn't seem like a hard list to get on. It's not a big profession. Do you know who number 51 was, you guys? Have you heard of him? Thomas Jefferson, okay? And if you're a planner, you know planner, you know how planners think. You know, Jane Jacobs is number 1. And she earned it. It's fine. She made some great observations, you guys. Death and Life of Great American Cities, check it out. Anyways, so on my Detroit road trip, you got to get down to Detroit once in a while. It's awesome. It's going through a renaissance right now. Really great to see redevelopment in a place where it has struggled for so long. Pretty much all my childhood, I never got to see a really nice Detroit. So it's really fun. What a fun word to use. It's just great to see that the city's doing really well. Bob encouraged me to go visit Cranbrook School, and I did. And if the name of that school is ringing a bell for you, you've probably seen the movie 8 Mile when Eminem's like, but I know something about you. You went to Cranbrook. That's a private school. And everybody's like, ah! So I went there, downtown Birmingham, Michigan, that is. Beautiful. The Cranbrook School campus, beautiful. Metro Detroit. Woo! There are some places there that I had never really explored Metro Detroit, and it was really interesting to see how beautiful some of those communities are. Woo. But yeah, downtown Birmingham is like a planner's dream come true. It's like, it's beautiful. It's incredible. Really compact. You feel like you're in Europe, but you don't have to deal with Europeans. Sorry to our European listeners, all 7 of you or whatever. So thank you so much to Bob for taking the time to explain the new urbanist movement and what's going on with that. Bob has played an integral role in the formation and the promotion and the development of new urbanist ideas, along with the original creators of it, like people that we all had to read about in planning school to pass those classes, those theory classes, Andres Duany, Peter Calthorpe, people whose names I'm blanking on. Obviously, I didn't pass that one. I just want to say a big thank you to Bob and anyone who comes on this podcast and helps to spread the good knowledge of people who have been working in this profession for a long time, because I know that there are so many people out there who are like me and need access to all of these great ideas. And I'm glad that we have a platform like podcasting to spread these ideas. So keep an eye out for the upcoming episodes. Keep a look out for those literature review episodes. Do they sound critically boring? Yes. Will they be? Maybe, because it's just me talking. But maybe, you know, I'm creating content, because if you don't, you perish, I've been told. So thanks again, everybody, for listening, and enjoy the episode. Thanks again to Bob. Yeah, the neighborhoods around here are beautiful.
They're really nice. Yeah, it's a really beautiful city. It's only 20,000 people, so it's about the size of Traverse City.
Yeah.
But it's a lot more intense.
Yeah, oh yeah. The traffic alone was intimidating. Yeah. All right, so Mr. Bob Gibbs, thanks for doing this. So you're going to talk about new urbanism. Do you want to introduce a little bit of your background, how you I mean, you've got a long tenure in this field. So what's the state of new urbanism?
Well, the movement was founded about 25 years ago by four architects whom all went to Princeton. They were friends in Princeton. Andreas Dewani, Stefanos Palazoides, Peter Kaldorp, and Dan Solomon. And they decided to change their practice from really doing modern buildings to doing traditional neighborhoods and traditional buildings. And it was based on a lecture that Leon Krier gave, a noted English architect. At the time, Andreas Dewani and his wife Elizabeth Platter-Zerberg were modernists. They had founded a modern firm in Miami, Arquitectonica. Mm-hmm. And he claims that they went home that night after that lecture and decided to change and to become traditionalists.
And at that time, by modernism, was that kind of like the Le Corbusier, like high-rise towers surrounded by green
space?
They
were doing glass high-rises that were really edgy Miami. Mm-hmm. They did a famous one in Miami that has a high-rise that has a window, a hole in the middle of the high-rise with a palm tree growing out.
Okay.
And really edgy, good quality work. So they decided to form this movement, the Congress for New Urbanism. At the time, I was working with Andreas on a number of projects in Providence, Rhode Island, and West Palm Beach and other cities. And they they nominated 20 people to do R&D to form the principles for the Congress for New Urbanism. And I was one of the 20 that they selected. And my specialty would be the commercial development and retail. I had just started my firm, Gibbs Planning Group, and I had left the Taubman Company. Taubman is a major shopping center developer in Bloomfield Hills, and I was their in-house urban planner. And I learned all about the science of building highly profitable shopping centers. Taubman was known for having centers that have the highest sales really in the world. They have 25 of the best performing centers. And I took those principles of how to have successful shopping centers and applied them to cities and to new urban communities. And the goal of the urbanist early on was to offer a economically viable and ecologically sustainable alternative to suburban sprawl. And the emphasis was to be an alternative and to be successful economically. And we set out to change the world by making it more profitable to build traditional places. We didn't really want to do it through zoning changes or regulation or through more restrictions. We wanted to open it up so that it would be legal to build traditional towns again. Mm-hmm. And really for the new towns to be more profitable than suburban sprawl. And that was considered a grandiose, pie-in-the-sky idea 25 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
At the time, the developers were just doing suburban sprawl.
Malls.
Malls. Nobody was putting housing on top of retail. Nobody was building walkable places. Seaside had just been launched, but that was it. And the ULI, the Urban Land Institute crowd, and the conventional developers really thought we were dreamers. But we've prevailed. The walkable town centers that we have planned now do generate higher profits for the developers. The home values have higher values. The retail stores have higher sales. And this new urban model economically works very well. It also works in cities. And we've been successful in revitalizing hundreds and hundreds of cities really around the world. We just recently worked in Warsaw, Poland, and we just worked in Mexico and Auckland, New Zealand. We've been applying these principles all over the country.
What's the difference in how you're planning these projects in, say, Auckland compared to Mexico? Because I'm sure the needs of the people are probably different.
Well, we try to calibrate the principles to the local cultures, and they're, of course, all very different. It was interesting, though, when we proposed this in New Zealand at the time, In Auckland, we were told by the developers that nobody would shop outside in New Zealand because it gets down to 65 degrees at night and it gets up to 80 degrees in the summer and it'd be too hot and too cold. So wow. You always hear lame excuses. Yeah. So in Mexico, it's quite different because people have retracted from urbanism because of a lot of the crime and a lot of cultural challenges that they're facing. So it's a very radical idea to have people shop outside again and to have public streets going through the town centers or revitalizing the city centers as the center of commerce. In Warsaw, Poland, where we just did a town center with another group, it's the first new town center built in Poland since before World War II.
Wow.
And for their last 50 or 60 years, they've been building complete suburban sprawl.
Really?
And
that's interesting that that's happening in Europe.
And yeah, it's common, and we're introducing a new model to them, which is traditional in Europe. You would think it would be common, and they're embracing it. Interesting thing about Poland is that they don't get a lot of sunlight like we don't in Michigan, and the government has a rule, a law, that all new residential dwellings have to have a certain minimum number of hours of direct sunlight in the windows.
Oh, interesting.
Which is really great. So all of the housing we designed had to be orientated to accommodate certain amount of sunlight, which I think is a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
So the basic premise of the new urbanism is to provide an alternative, but to have it take hold by making it more profitable. And about 3/4 of our work are in existing cities. Only about 25% of our work are new greenfield developments. But unfortunately, we've been branded as a greenfield planning movement because the greenfield ones that we build get all the publicity.
Right.
And when we do a revitalization in Memphis, Tennessee, or in Providence, Rhode Island, or some neighborhood in Detroit, it doesn't receive the press. But most of our work is to revitalize cities, because that's the real green thing to do. People that live in cities have a smaller carbon footprint. And we think the best way of stopping suburban sprawl is to have people live in cities. And a lot of the environmentalists that initially fought us, because we like medium to high densities, we think more is more. And a lot of the old environmental groups at the time would say, no, we want everybody to live on a one-acre lot or a two-acre lot, and we don't want any development at all or very low density. And they've come around and they've realized that the best environmental thing they can do to save the farmland and woodlands is to have people live in high densities in city centers, or at least offer that as an alternative. So we advocate this as an antidote for suburban sprawl. As an environmental movement, we see ourselves as a green movement by making it more dense.
It seems like a social movement, too, in terms of just...
It is, because that's an interesting point. The number one problem right now with senior citizens is loneliness, mm-hmm. and it's getting classified as a disease. And so we work hard at building neighborhoods that not only have the physical form to be walkable, small blocks and houses up to the street and things to walk to, but that they also have a social realm. So I like to build neighborhoods with community gardens and dog parks and coffee shops and cafes, so that you can go and run into your neighbors and sit and have a conversation and make friends and not be lonely. And I think that's the future. And I think a lot of people that live in really beautiful homes or condominiums are lonely. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of health benefits of that. You live longer. If you have more friends, of course, you have a higher quality of life and less disease. So we have, I think, worked out, based on the 1910s and 20s planning principles of Clarence Stein and Olmsted and John Nolan, the physical way of making towns. We know how to make good neighborhoods physically. We're now crossing over to how to make them from a sociological point of view. So we were just hired by an Ohio developer to help him do this sociology of a neighborhood. And what that means is, what's the ideal mix of people? How many people? How much diversity? What age diversity? What income? What educational diversity can you have for the best neighborhoods? So we've been asked to engage anthropologists and sociologists and psychologists, and we're studying the best neighborhoods in the country and breaking down the dynamics. And we found that there are limits to the diversity that you can have with income and age and such. And so we're planning neighborhoods now so that ideally you can live there for 3 or 4 housing cycles. One of the advantages of a neighborhood over a subdivision is that in a subdivision, there's a monoculture of housing types.
Right.
They're all 4-bedroom colonials, or they're all 3-bedroom ranches, or they're all whatever. And the challenge with that is, on average, every American moves every 5 years. 20% of Americans move every year. So every 5 years, you either outgrow your house and you need a 4th bedroom, or you don't need the 4th bedroom and you want to downsize to a 2-bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And in a subdivision or in an apartment complex or a condo complex, you can't do that. You have to move out of the subdivision and find a new condo complex or a new place to live. In a true neighborhood, we like to build a variety of housing types so that you can move up or down through 3 housing cycles without having to leave the neighborhood. Ideally, it would be all your housing cycles, but that's unrealistic. So, for example, if you're a young professional, you might have a micro apartment or a loft studio apartment that you can rent at a reasonable rate. And then when you get married, maybe have a larger apartment or a condominium that you can move into. And then when you have a family, maybe a small home with 3 bedrooms or so in which you can have your family. And there's so many advantages of that. First of all, you keep your friends for a long time because when you're leaving the neighborhood, you break your friendships. And you can keep close to your friends. Your children have a diversity of age. They can have a senior citizen living across the street from them, or they can have a young professional that can be a role model for their career or whatever living down the street. So that's what we strive to do, is to make neighborhoods that you can grow in and grow out of without having to leave. And that's what we're focusing right now. We're doing a master plan for the city of Birmingham. And Birmingham is a city of 20,000 people, and it has great neighborhoods. But we're studying the neighborhoods and trying to fill in maybe pieces missing in the neighborhoods. In some of the neighborhoods, they have great coffee shops that you can walk to and bakeries and corner markets where you can buy a loaf of bread. Other neighborhoods don't. So we're rounding those out and making proposals to the neighborhoods, pointing out things that we think they could add to make it a complete neighborhood, and then asking the residents if they want to change the plan and zoning to allow it. Some will and some won't. Some people are adamantly opposed to having a coffee shop within a mile or two of their house, and that just blows their mind.
Right.
Or they're opposed to the idea of an apartment building being within sight of their house.
Right.
Which is fine. You know, that's up to their choice. Our role is to point out what the complete neighborhood opportunities are, and then have people decide, and that's what we always try to do. What's funny is when we build these complete neighborhoods, either from scratch or infilling, we find once it's done, the people that were opposed to it love it. And they'll write us letters and say, I just love going down and getting a loaf of bread, or my kids love riding their bike to the drugstore and being able to get a popsicle or something. It's like a whole big thing for them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the ideal.
It is.
It's the ideal life, really.
And the realtors tell us that neighborhoods that have corner markets or Starbucks that you can walk to have higher values. I saw recently that apartments that can walk within 5 minutes to a Starbucks or a Whole Foods rent for 18% more.
Wow.
And homes in Birmingham and other cities like Ann Arbor or Northville or Plymouth or Rochester, there's a premium for the home the closer you are to the main street. And the realtors actually map out block by block the houses that are closer to downtown Rochester or Northville pay a premium, even though there is more congestion, there's more noise. Sometimes a stranger will park in front of your house and go to a restaurant in downtown.
Right.
People like that. And not everybody likes it. Only about a third of the Americans really like that idea of living in a mixed use like that. About a third of Americans, studies show, really dislike it. They really want to live on a half-acre lot surrounded by trees where they can't see their neighbor,
right?
Which is fine.
Do you think that's just a matter of that's just what they're used to?
I think it's what they're used to, but I also just think people are different. Some people yeah. like living in the woods, and some people like living on big lots and having a lot of privacy, and other people don't.
Yeah, and it's kind of probably the amount of stimulation that you can take varies right. by so many
right.
people, too.
And, yeah, which is fine. Our goal in the new urbanism is to offer that as a building option mm-hmm. so that you can have a choice. And we acknowledge that a third or more people just don't like it, which is fine. When we started this 30 years ago, this kind of planning, nobody was building walkable communities. If you wanted a new house, you had to live in a subdivision or you had to buy an old house with old bathrooms and old kitchens and garages that are too small to fit your car, and then spend a lot of money to renovate the house.
Right.
So our goal is just to provide the option, and it has been highly it's been too successful because the communities that we build now become hyper expensive. And we researched that, and we found that about a third, like I said earlier, about 30% of the home buyers want to live in a walkable neighborhood. And they will pay 20 to 30% more to live in that neighborhood. And only 1% of the homes being built today, the new homes are being built in walkable neighborhoods. So you have a demand by 30% and you have a 1% supply. So you have a out of whack supply and demand model.
Right.
So when we build these, the houses get super expensive. It's not unusual for a house to double in value within a couple of years if it's in a walkable neighborhood. There's a community we worked on in the Atlanta area where they built townhomes that were supposed to sell for $400,000, and they tripled the price to $1.2 million within the first 6 months.
Wow. And who's driving that demand? Is it what age group or what?
It's all age groups,
okay.
But it's especially being driven by the millennials, the 20-year-olds, whom about 3/4 of them don't want to live in a subdivision on a cul-de-sac without sidewalks. About a third do, but about 2/3 don't. And by the 60 and 70-year-olds, the empty nesters. The empty nesters, many of whom raised their families in subdivisions, want to retire to a place where they can walk. And you probably know that the millennials and the empty nesters are the two largest demographic group of all time in America.
Yeah.
And both groups, the 20-year-olds and the 60-year-olds, really for the first time in history, want the same house.
Yeah, that's interesting.
They want 2 to 3 bedrooms. They want a den. They want a large open area. They want sidewalks, and they want to be able to walk to get a loaf of bread and a cup of coffee and a beer. So for the first time ever, we have two age groups that are very different wanting the same house type.
That's interesting. Do you think that's a long-term? Because I know my fear as a planner is that the millennials are going to drive this inner city investment because they want those housing types, and then they're going to turn mid-30s and say, all right, back to the suburbs.
That's a really good point. A lot of the millennials are moving to inner cities like Pittsburgh or Detroit or St. Louis before they have children. Mm-hmm. And we think a lot of them will want to leave because of the schools or to have a larger home or a little backyard for their dog. The number one thing millennials want right now is something walkable, and they want a place for their dog. They love dog parks.
Yeah, I get that a lot.
We're seeing that the millennials moving, when they're leaving the city center, they're moving to the early ring suburbs, the mm-hmm. suburbs that were built in the 50s and 60s.
Like your Hamtramck's,
Or the Ferndales, mm-hmm. Where you have houses that were ranch houses built in the 50s. It might be an 1,100 or 1,200 square foot ranch with tiny kitchens and bathrooms. But they're in walkable places.
Yeah.
So we're seeing that. But it's interesting that the housing community is not building the new urbanism as much as the market demands. And I think a lot of that has to do with zoning. It is still illegal in almost every city that we work in to build walkable communities.
That was a disappointing thing about reading Charles Montgomery's Happy City, is at the end he goes, all these ideas are mostly illegal in most communities.
They are. We get called into city because we're known for doing just, we only do new urbanism work. That's the reason I'm such a small firm. We don't do subdivisions. But we get called by cities all the time saying, please find a developer. We want a little cottage court around a little square. We want townhouses or live-work townhouses. Find a developer to find a piece of property and make the proposal. And when we do that, almost always when they get to the planning board, there's a mob that screams that the small houses are going to hurt their property values, and the planning board backs down. So yeah. It's very hard, and it's very just hard to get through the engineering, and so you can't blame the national home builders for building what's easy.
Right. Yeah, it's always cheaper. Almost always cheaper to build in the greenfields.
And it's easier. It's legal. Even communities that are implementing the form-based code are still making it hard to build the right thing.
Yeah, when you make recommendations to these communities and do these developments and work with the developers, what's the ideal code to be working with? Is it like a performance-based, form-based?
I prefer a form-based code which describes the shape of the building and the height of the building and the placement of the building on the site, closer to the street with the parking on the side or the parking on the back. And they may allow 3 stories or 4 stories or 2 stories. But the community doesn't regulate what's in the building very much. Mm-hmm. So if you want to build 20 micro apartments, or if you want to build 10 luxury apartments or an office or a retail store or a senior housing, you can do that as long as the shape of the building is right. The funny thing about the form-based codes, though, is that when we propose this, we still are getting denied. Right now I have a client that was denied to build a senior center.
Pretty non-controversial, you know, in most
independent,
instances.
Independent, yeah. Fully independent living, part of a town center. But because it was near a tot lot and a daycare center, the planning board thought that seniors wouldn't want to live by a daycare center. They thought it would be too
loud
for
them. Almost the opposite, isn't it?
Yeah.
Seniors love kids.
A lot of them, yeah. They live longer, they have happier lives. So we actually had to table this for 6 months to convince the planning board members that seniors do like living by, some like living by children, and those that don't will put on the back of the building. But mm-hmm. They just couldn't get their arms around doing that.
So how are you communicating with the, is the retail kind of the easiest way to, can you talk more about the retail and how you're convincing communities that this is the best option to go with the new urbanism designs?
Yeah, having active cafes and retail shops is essential for a real neighborhood, a complete neighborhood. We specialize in making the retail work. And that's hard. That's become a little bit abused by some of the planners because everybody likes retail on the ground level. So a lot of cities are now requiring retail on the ground level everywhere. And retail doesn't work everywhere. It has to have at least 10,000 cars per day driving by, or it has to have certain site selection criteria. And we're finding a lot of communities that are adapting the form-based code are requiring retail everywhere where it's not sustainable. So the multifamily apartment builders are now building the retail, and in their proforma, they're assuming it's going to be empty for the entire life. And they're zeroing out the value of the retail.
Oh, wow.
Because they build it and they can't lease it.
Yeah, that was an issue that I was seeing pop up in Lansing along Michigan Ave. There's a lot of empty storefronts, and those, I mean, the apartments themselves are completely occupied and worth a lot, but at the bottom, no one.
There's hundreds of miles of empty retail because it was required to go in the wrong place. So what we like to do is we require that the ground level be built to allow retail, a high ceiling, at least a 12-foot ceiling, mm-hmm. at least 70% clear glass on the storefront, and a real retail storefront. But if the retail won't survive there, that's okay. We will let it be an accounting office or an advertising firm or a hair salon or even a residential unit until the area matures to allow retail. So when we do the retail plans, we put codes in that require the first level to be retail, but we don't require retail. We let the market decide what's going to go there. Disney did this with Celebration 20 years ago. They planned retail everywhere, but it wouldn't work, so they allowed first-level lofts in the storefronts for the first 10 or 15 years. And then when the market matured, they put in stores.
Okay. So how has your work changed with new urbanism and in the internet age where retail is moving to an online format? It seems like design has never been more important in creating an experience for people
That's
to get them into the
question,
retail.
Yes. The retail industry is quickly collapsing. The idea of getting in your car and driving to a shopping center and parking and walking into a store and hoping they have the brand and the color and the size at the price you want to pay in the store.
Just finding parking alone drives me away.
It's a quaint, nostalgic idea. It's past. When you can go online and you can pick from every size, every color that the manufacturer makes and have it in your house in 2 days and usually get a discount, it's hard to compete with that. So we're seeing that the first casualty of that are the major big box power centers where you go to buy office supplies or sporting goods or toys. Those have become commodities. And so you've seen Toys R Us close. You're seeing the office supply stores close.
Sears, yeah.
Sears is closing because whatever you buy there is just a transaction. It's not a fun experience necessarily to go into an office store and buy a box of paper clips.
Right.
So the first casualty are these big box power centers. And they're called community centers by the industry, the shopping center industry. They tend to be 300 to 500,000 square feet in size. And those are closing, and those will mostly be gone within the next decade.
Is there anything that communities can do to... I know it's becoming more popular to take away some of those parking spaces, the acres of parking spaces around these places and put apartments next to them to get people
in. That's
right.
The good news is those community centers are usually located in great locations. They're on major streets. And they were all built in the 70s and 80s with twice the parking needed today.
Yeah.
Literally, 10 cars per 1,000
square
feet.
Yeah, what you need on Black Friday, and that's it.
Yeah, so now you only need a third of that or half of that. So you can retrofit those with apartments by just building in the parking lots. You can build retail along the highway. Those are called jewel boxes. And they're little standalone retail stores built along the highway, often with residential or office above. The city of Troy, Michigan has been a great model of that along Big Beaver Road. It's sort of a suburban city without a downtown, but they've been retrofitting their offices and their large community centers by putting in these jewel boxes. We call the jewel boxes liner buildings in the new urbanism. They just fit right in the parking lot. You don't lose any parking, and it adds a lot of value to the center, and then by having the retail along the street, it makes it more walkable. The second casualty are malls, and about half of the malls are expected to close within the next 5 to 8 years. Only the malls in really great locations or in high-income areas are going to be surviving, and that's about half. The thing that shocks me that I just learned very recently is that the old standby center, the neighborhood center anchored with a grocery store and a drugstore, which we thought would always be around, it's always been the safe harbor for investors, is threatened because people are now buying their groceries online or they're picking them up at the store. And there are forecasts now that more than 50% of all groceries now will be purchased online within the next 5 years. So that could wipe out a whole category of center. The only centers that can compete are those that give the shopper an experience they can't get online, which requires good placemaking. Mm-hmm. Places that have parks and squares, places where you can socialize and meet people and talk to strangers or talk to your neighbors, with benches and fountains and little ponds and just great urbanism. Those can outcompete the internet because you can combine buying that pair of shoes with a social experience, which people are yearning for. So this whole new category that the new urbanist invented called town centers, where you have housing on top of retail and you have squares and plazas, those are thriving. And the towns, there's five or six really great town centers in the country, but there's about 150 that are very, very good. The extreme example is in Los Angeles. It's called The Grove, and its sister is the Americana. Those town centers have more visitors than Disneyland. They're in Los Angeles, and they're packed. They have sales of four or five times the sales per square foot. Locally, in Rochester Hills, there's one called the Village of Rochester, which we planned ourselves about 15 years ago for the Aikens group. It has a main street with shops. And then there's a great one in Columbus, Ohio, called Easton Town Center. So to compete with the internet, you have to give an experience that you can't get online.
And what does that exactly look like? I know you said benches, typical placemaking elements, but what does the retail itself look like?
The storefronts themselves have to be really interesting and beautiful and artistically designed. The space has to be well landscaped. And believe it or not, we can come pretty close with the new town centers by building really fake towns. The better retailers right now are seeking real historic downtowns. They like to go to the Northvilles and the Birminghams and the Charlestons and Alexandria, Virginias. They like better now the historic towns. And that's because when they build a store in a historic town that is well managed, that has high design standards, high architectural codes and historic preservation, that those stores can outperform the malls or the town centers. So kind of just by dumb luck, the future of retail is returning back to city centers. But only city centers that are well planned and they have high design standards for the buildings. They have to require a good signage, small signage, historical type signage. They have to require buildings to be built out of quality materials like stone or brick or wood. And those cities are now becoming the safe haven for all the best retailers in the country.
When you get down to exactly what materials you need to have and matching the local character, and I think it comes from partly when they talk about millennials is the need for authenticity when they go and buy something.
That's right.
Or go somewhere or live somewhere.
They want it to be real. And it doesn't have to be historic. It doesn't have to look like it's from the 18th century. It just has to be creative and innovative. So we advise we work for a lot of cities, and we advise them to hire local artists to design the storefronts to be really beautiful. Up in Petoskey, there's a great coffee shop the door is surrounded by coffee mugs embedded into the storefront. Petoskey probably has some of the best storefronts in the country. It's really nice to a high standard. A lot of cities will tell me that they're going to be competitive by selling brands that you can't buy in the mall, or by lowering their architectural standards. And I don't buy that. I think you have to have good standards. And you should sell the goods and services that people like to buy in your city. If people like buying Patagonia or Apple computers or Talbot's women's apparel or Brooks Brothers, I think those stores should be in your city rather than out in a mall. And we've been advising Charleston, South Carolina, for years, and the Mayor Riley adopted that principle that he wanted all the brands that people like to buy in Charleston, but he wanted them to be built in an authentic, historic-looking storefront that was of high quality. So he's embraced that. Most of the cities that we work for will tell us that they don't want any national brands in their downtown, that they want all the national brands to be out in the suburbs, and that they only want the kinds of stores that people don't like to shop at in their downtowns, which is quaint, and it's nice to go to a store where you can see something that you don't really want to buy. But I think the city centers, to outcompete the suburbs, should sell what people like, even if it is a name brand, even if it is a Patagonia or an Apple computer.
So what's changed with the new urbanist movement since the time that this movement started to now? What have been the greatest changes and challenges?
The first thing is that we let others define what we are. Most architects think of us as an architectural movement. And because our projects got published that had traditional architecture, we're seen mistakenly as an architectural design style, which we're not. Many of the best new urban communities are very modern. But what's changed is I think we're kind of at a turning point because we achieved all of our objectives we set out to do 25 years ago. Cities are being revitalized. Investors are preferring to spend money in cities and build housing and retail. And when they can't go to cities, they're building beautiful new towns and new neighborhoods. So we're now looking more global. We're focusing more on climate change and transportation and driverless cars and all those sorts of things. So it's been surprising at how fast these principles had embraced. And now the developers that shunned us 25 years ago, the Urban Land Institute crowd, have fully embraced it. And I think they've taken our principles one step further than we even hoped to. They're now regularly building high-density housing that's planned really well with nice materials, and they're building parking structures. So I think we're looking more broader and we're looking more holistic.
I think the interesting thing for me with this movement is that whenever you talk to people, I work in a lot of rural areas that, you know, these ideas take longer to get there, is that people don't realize that we were in that auto-oriented design phase for not that long. It hasn't, in the blip of human history, it's a blip, you know? And
that's really good. Yeah, you're right. The suburban movement was only about 50 years.
Right.
And traditional planning has been around since really 4,000 or 5,000 years.
The agora.
Finally
going back to that.
Yeah. I think the hard part for us now is still having it be legal. It's still harder to build this. I just had a project denied in Petoskey 2 years ago because we were proposing a building one story taller than they wanted.
Were you trying to fill the hole there?
We were trying to fill what's known as the hole. It's a whole block. It's a giant hole in the ground. We did a proposal to give the city 100 parking spaces underground, to give them a cinema and a hotel and retail and housing. Which would have been great, I think, for the city. We proposed a conference center.
It's a prime location, too.
And having a conference center there would bring a lot of bodies to those retail shops. We proposed a lot of market-rate housing, the missing middle housing. Mm-hmm. But it was overwhelmingly denied by the city because we were proposing four stories and they only wanted three. And I think, in that case, Petoskey, and they're not alone, this is very common, they're not living up to their responsibility. That hotel we propose now is being built a mile and a half south of town. It's just opening a Marriott hotel in a new shopping center with new housing and new shops. And that's too far away for those Marriott hotel residents to walk into downtown Petoskey. And I think that these quaint codes of not allowing your city to grow or your town to grow to be a city because you don't want a four-story building is precipitating more suburban sprawl.
Yeah.
And it's hurting the city center. That Petoskey, and I'm not singling out Petoskey, this happens in almost every city we work in, they should have more density. And I think they should have density that's planned well, that's not too tall, and not 10 or 20 story buildings, of course, but that's the right scale. And I guess one thing that the new urbanists have done is that they've gone from just the binary choice of being rural or urban. And now we've defined urbanism as seven categories, from a hamlet to a village to a small town, to a large town, to a city, to a metropolis.
I know that I've got it's infiltrated my thought process. You know, when I drive somewhere now, I'm like, oh, what transect am I in? Here we go.
Yeah, it's called the transect. So thanks for that. And this is probably the most important thing, because I think the people in Petoskey and other cities say, well, we're a town, we don't want to be a city, which is fine. But there's lots of steps between a two-story town and a 10-story city.
Right.
And it translates not only with the building height, but with the building design. Towns have a more simple architecture. They don't have Beaux-Arcs, limestone buildings with fancy Corinthian columns. And they have a lower density, but everything, the signage, the benches, every detail should be calibrated to whether it wants to be a town or whether it wants to be a city. Birmingham, we did a plan with Andreas Dewani 20 years ago for the city of Birmingham, and at the time it was a town. They only allowed two-story buildings, and they had a lot of surface parking lots. And our job was to see why nobody was building anything on the parking lots. And we met with the developers, and they said, well, we need 5 stories to make it pencil out. Mm-hmm. So Andreas Dewani asked the city if they'd like to grow from being a town to a city. And they did, and he explained the difference. A city has 5-story buildings, it has traffic congestion, but it has lots of restaurants, and it has a nightlife, and it has places where you can live. And the city considered it, and they decided to grow to a city. So the city in Birmingham changed its zoning from 2 stories to 5 stories and implemented the plan which allowed it to grow to be a city. Birmingham now, a city of only 21,000 people, has almost 8 million square feet of commercial. It has the highest office rents in the Midwest, the top 10 office rents in the country. Wow. And some of the most expensive housing prices. We're doing a plan now for Birmingham because it's almost gotten too successful and probably has to be calmed down. So I have a big issue with cities that are overly loved, where people say, I don't want to change the city. I want to keep it exactly. And even if you have to go out and buy Farmer Jones Farm and turn it into a subdivision, I'd rather have a subdivision outside than a city. I don't think that's very sustainable.
Yeah, I get that a lot with community. Well, they actually contradict themselves, because they say we want to maintain our character as a small town, but then you say, okay, well, what do you want to see here? And they go, well, we want to have walkable streets, shopping, and it's like, right. You have to choose one.
In Petoskey, what really surprised me is the two most beloved buildings in Petoskey. They have two historic buildings. One is the Cutler's Building, and another one is the Old Masonic Temple. Both of those buildings, their favorite buildings, are illegal because they're too tall. If those buildings were to burn down, they couldn't be rebuilt today. And I don't want to pick on Petoskey. This is really true everywhere we go. And Petoskey's a great town. I just ranked Petoskey for USA Today. I just did an article on the 10 best cities in the country, and I ranked Petoskey as one of the 10 best cities in the country. I think it's as good as any place we've been.
Hey, stop. You're telling people, you're giving out these hidden gems in northern Michigan. We don't want,
I know.
We want to maintain our small coastal character.
Please, you know, their Chamber of Commerce switchboard lit up when that came up. But Petoskey is great. Michigan has a lot of great cities.
Oh, yeah. People don't know about Charlevoix,
Traverse City, Harbor Springs, yeah. Northville, Plymouth. We have a lot of great cities in Michigan and the Midwest.
How have the Michigan cities specifically been receptive to the new urbanist movement?
The cities are behind the new urbanism here, and it's really led by the state. The state Michigan Economic Development Corporation has been advocating new urban principles, and the Michigan Municipal League has been all behind it. They can't call it new urbanism because, for a lot of reasons, it's not a popular term right now, so they call it placemaking.
Yeah.
Or redevelopment-ready cities, mm-hmm. which is fine, and call it whatever you want. But they've embraced the principles. They've helped make it legal. They've helped giving cities incentives to do it. The problem in Michigan is that most of our real estate developers are not very innovative, and the private sector is still resisting it here in Michigan. We do almost no work in Michigan. All of our private sector work has to be in other states because the Michigan developers just don't want to try anything different. And I don't know why. Sometimes they tell me in Michigan nobody will walk outside because it's too cold in the winter.
Come to Traverse City in the winter, yeah.
But I think when we've done new urban projects in Michigan, they've done extremely well. They've
gotten hyper expensive. But Michigan's unique there in that, in the Carolinas and in California and Ohio, Indiana, New York, to New England, in most of the other parts of the country, the new urban planning principles have been embraced by the developers and they build them extensively. In Michigan, it's still very rare. I think there's only 10 true new urban communities in Michigan, and I think we plan 9 out of the 10.
And are,
I wish there were more.
How many of those were in downtown or existing communities, and how many were green? Because I know Cherry Hill Village is...
That's a good question. We did one. We planned one in Northville and Birmingham. We've done some work in Grosse Pointe. We did a lot of the work for Bedrock early on in Detroit. You're right, in Grand Rapids. Most of it is still greenfield. Okay. And unfortunately, some of it got started the day before the biggest recession of all time.
Yeah.
And so they had slow sales, and people said, well, there you go, I told you so. But eventually they'll come around here.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're getting near that hour mark. Anything else on new urbanism that you think is...
I'm thrilled to be talking to you about it.
Yeah, I've gotten to talk to multiple planners today. So as a planner,
it's been the best thing that happened to us, meeting Andreas Dewani and Peter Kelthorpe and all of those great planners. And I'm very proud of what we do. We are very small, but it's worked out very well for us.
Can you promote the, if you want, the resources that you've worked on that other communities might look at if they're wanting to implement some of these ideas?
Well, there's a couple of good books about it. One is Jeff Speck and Andreas Dewani's book, Sustainable Nation. I like to read The Geography of Nowhere. It's sort of a humorous book by Jim Kunstler. I wrote a book called Principles for Urban Retail, which defines how to build new town centers or how to revitalize your downtown. The Congress for New Urbanism has a great website with lots of resources. We have an institute myself called the Urban Retail Institute, and we have a Facebook group where every day we post research about the urban retail, of how to develop urban retail, the Urban Retail Institute. And I host a cable show, Michigan Planning Today, which every week we interview urban planners and developers.
Oh, okay.
And we talk about new urban projects. So it's broadcast around the state. It's called Michigan Planning Today. And, of course, we have the social media for it. So it's been very exciting. The Urban Land Institute, the Michigan Municipal League, the Urban Land Institute, those all now have new urban sections. But they don't like to call it new urban. They call it different things. Shopping center guys... I get a kick out of them. They don't like anything urban. They're, for some reason, they don't like things that are urban. Most people don't, I guess. So they call their town centers open air centers. That's the buzzword for their town centers.
Okay. But
whatever you call them, they're all the same thing.
Yeah, as long as people are walking around, what difference
is it? The one thing I have to caution about is that when communities try to build a hybrid between half suburban and half urban, those usually are big flops. Hmm. They usually do go bankrupt. They're not walkable, and they're not suburban enough. So if you're going to do one or the other, you should do, you know, do a great suburb. They're beautiful, great subdivision or condo complex, or fully embrace the new urban principles. The hybrids generally are economic disasters because people lose the privacy without things to walk to. So you have the worst of both worlds. You might have a small lot, but you can't walk to a coffee shop or to a market. So those are the worst of both worlds. But Michigan has great examples. Cherry Hill in Canton, which we worked on, the Village of Rochester. Westwood Common in Beverly Hills is the first new urban community in Michigan. It's 25 homes around a little English close. Howell Town Commons, we did that out in Howell. That's really beautiful. Macomb has one, the Macomb Town Commons. So there's a few here.
Okay. I'm excited to see what goes on in Phoenix with this new, was it Phoenix or Tempe, where they're doing that development with no cars?
Yeah, Tempe. I think it's Tempe's experimenting with it. Maybe every 50 years, planners like to experiment with doing places without cars.
Yeah,
but,
we'll see.
Those are risky, but when they work well.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Bob.
Great. Nice to meet you.
Welcome To is brought to you by the Land Information Access Association. For more information about what we do, go to liaa.org. Music for this podcast was provided by Blue Dot Sessions. Talk to you guys next time.